Welcome to another of the Maine Humanities Council's Humanities on Demand podcasts. This episode is a recording of a talk held on September 10th, 2014, at the Portland Public Library, as part of their Brown Bag Lecture Series. We join Debbie Irving as she discusses her book, Waking Up White. Debbie Irving, racial justice educator and writer, and Shay Stewart Boulay, executive director of Community Change Incorporated, blogger, and past Think and Drink speaker, led a program at the Portland Public Library on the night preceding this talk. About 150 people came to the library for Tell Me the Truth, exploring the heart of cross-racial conversations. This podcast builds on that discussion while taking a closer look at Irving's book.
I want to thank the library, and I want to thank Dave Nicholas, who I thanked last night, too. Dave is my cousin-in-law, and when I was just wrapping up the book, he was the one who said, you know, the Portland Public Library is really into engaging people around this subject, and I want you to get in touch. He's the one who put me in touch with, I think, Rachel first. So I wouldn't be here if it weren't for Dave, who's a board member here and a family member for me. And I have a couple family members here, which is always great. It doesn't happen in every city, but it's sure to happen in Portland, Maine. I want to thank people who came last night. Raise your hand if you were here last night and you have come again today. Okay, thanks so much, because one of the first things I've been asked to do is kind of recap last night. So we're going to use our collective memories to talk about what happened. So the name of the event was Tell Me the Truth, Exploring the Heart of Cross-Racial Conversations. And, you know, Shay and I, for those of you who don't know Shay, she's a black woman who lives here in Maine. She has a blog called Black Girl in Maine, where she writes about the experience of being a black woman in a state that battles between Maine and Vermont to take first place as the whitest state in the union. So she's very outspoken about what it feels like to be a black woman in a white space. And I'm very outspoken about what it felt like to realize that there was such a thing as a white space and whiteness, and that I was a part of it. And so we use our different experiences to talk about what is it about our society that allows me to have my experience and her to have her experience, and how can we work cross-racially and in terms of friendships, in terms of in our organizations, hopefully at the government level, how can we work towards racial justice? So we thought, well, the best thing we can do is really model an honest conversation. Shay started off by reading the results of the Kerner Commission, and she talked about after the race riots in the 1960s, Lyndon Johnson ordered a commission of white, I believe they were all men, to study the race problem in America and come up with recommendations. That is commonly referred to, that group, as the Kerner Commission. And their report came away, she actually read from the report, I'm going to paraphrase it, basically is, race is not a problem belonging to black people. Racism is a problem belonging to white people who have created the institutions and the whole idea of racism. And white people are going to need to solve this issue. And when she read what the social dynamics, the Kerner Commission talked about basically racism has created two worlds in one country. And Shay said, you know, as she was reading through that in preparation for this, it just struck her that we are right where we were in many ways 50 years ago. And how disheartening that is should be disheartening to all of us, because racism belongs to all of us. And it should belong as much to white people as anyone else, if not more so. And she talked about how disheartening it is to be working in this field, knowing that we are right where we were 50 years ago, having the same conversations. And then we decided that what we really wanted to do was model what it looks like to just have this personal conversation. So we talked about where we were during the events of Ferguson. And my story was that I was up in northern Maine, in Houlton, Maine, where my grandparents came from and where I try to get to as often as I can. And I was doing this two-week thing. I had unplugged from all my social media. I said, I'm unplugging for 2 weeks. I told everyone, don't call me, don't speak to me. I really need 2 weeks with my family. And that was the day that I left was the day that Michael Brown was shot. And so I had this real struggle of, do I unplug? And I ultimately decided I'm going to, because if I don't restore myself, I was so burned out from getting the book published and then doing all this promotion and traveling around. And for me to say I'm going to unplug, that is a huge white luxury. And Shay talked about how it was impossible for her to unplug. She has family in St. Louis, for one. And even if she didn't, just as a black woman, when there are race riots going on in this country, she felt nervous to leave her house. And it wasn't that she felt that her life was in danger. It's that she was so traumatized, I don't know a black person who wasn't so traumatized during that event that they were losing sleep, not eating, eating too much, watching TV incessantly, unable to watch TV. It was a crisis in their soul. And the idea of unplugging would be inconceivable. So just the idea that I could unplug, that's always available to me as a white person, that I really don't have to address racism if I don't want to. And I think it's the first time since I started this journey that I had an experience like that where I intentionally invoked my white privilege. So we talked about that. And then we talked a lot about what I thought was really interesting, and maybe we'll do this on the front end today, was towards the end of the evening, we said, you know, man, here we are in this packed house and with this very diverse range of people in the room, people who have lived and breathed this their whole life and people who are just maybe start thinking about it or coming here just because they're related to me. And wow, what an opportunity to see who's in your community. So I don't know who knows my story and who doesn't, so I'm just going to do a quick summary of it. So I was raised in a suburb outside of Boston, Winchester, Massachusetts. And until the age of 22, I had a very isolated, white, upper-middle-class life. And then I came back to Boston, and I was always drawn to the city, to Cambridge, to Boston. I loved the arts, and I immediately got involved in the arts and ended up very quickly, because of my social connections, as a general manager of a nonprofit or a smallish nonprofit organization. And I realized how easy it was for me to raise money, because, of course, I had all these connections to raise money, these funders told me, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the inner city. And I had never in my life, I didn't even know what inner city meant or what code language that was. And so I ended up creating all these programs in communities that were almost exclusively communities of color, after school programs for kids that involved matching artists and to programs. And I went in there and just made the assumption that I knew what these groups wanted and what would be good for them. I raised money to bus children from programs into downtown Boston to go to daytime theater performances because I was sure that was what would be great for them. And then I went on to become a public school teacher in the Cambridge Public Schools. Oh, and let me back up for a minute and say, I felt tension in the air when I was working cross-racially in my nonprofit years. And I couldn't explain the tension. I couldn't explain the residential footprint I saw of, you know, why were some neighborhoods, you know, white and shiny, and why were these other black and brown neighborhoods dilapidated? You know, why couldn't the people living in those, what was wrong? Why didn't those people want to do something and work harder and better their lives and, you know, live more like me? This was my logic because I was so under-informed and educated about how our country has been built. And then I became a Cambridge public school teacher, and now I'm in a room where there isn't segregation because I'm in racially mixed classrooms, and yet, in terms of student achievement and family involvement, there was a huge racial divide. The white children soared, and as the years went on, increasingly so, and the black and brown children, by fourth and fifth grade, were pretty much just like head checked out. And I couldn't explain any of it. So there was this 25-year period where I was a nonprofit manager, then a teacher, and I knew there was a problem, and I was going to diversity. I was on diversity committees. I even started one without understanding what whiteness was or what systemic racism was. So I was getting more and more frantic with this idea that there's something I'm not getting and I don't know what it is. I ended up at the age of 48 in a course at Wheelock College. I was going to get my special ed degree, and the first required course was racial and cultural identity, and I was going to learn about other people and other cultures and, you know, see what I could learn about them so I could figure out how to teach them. And in the first class, the teacher said to me, you know, this is going to be one of the hardest things you've ever done, because for the next 6 months, what you are going to do is the deepest dive into your own racial identity. And I looked around the room, which was racially mixed, and I thought, well, what am I going to do? Because I didn't think I had a racial identity. cut to the end of that course, I was so angry and grief-stricken. What I had learned about our country, what I had learned about my role as a white person, what I had what I understood about my own family history, was so devastating to me that is why I decided to take a year off and do more research, get to know more people around the country doing this work, and write this book. That 1 year turned into four. And, you know, I just want to acknowledge here that this whole entire book is built on white privilege. The time that it took me to do this and the money it took me to do it and the education that allowed me and the confidence all comes from being raised to feel like, getting a lot of money as a white person and being able to climb the socioeconomic ladder, and not only white but multi-generational white. So many generations to compound that wealth. But the confidence, the sense, you know, one of the things Shay said last night was, you know, as a black person, I don't really feel like this is my, like, I live here, this is my country, I say I'm an American, but I don't feel like I'm ever made to feel like I belong. I totally felt like I belong. So when I decided I could write a book, it felt to me like, of course you can write a book. And I understand now that that's a big part of that comes a little bit with the whiteness. So it took me 4 years, and here I am. So the big question is, what did I learn? It says on the back, one aha moment, and that's just good marketing. There were many, many, many moments. There still are moments. There was a moment on stage last night where I had an aha moment. But I think the biggest thing for me was learning about the GI Bill, and I find in talking to other white people that this is the example that you can give to help white people understand racism. Most people confuse racism with prejudice. So prejudice is an equal opportunity. Anybody in this room and I, no matter what color or class or age, whatever, we could have all kinds of assumptions about one another. And that's prejudice. We could prejudge each other. But that's not going to impact whether or not you get a job. That's not going to impact whether you get stopped by the police on the way home. This is just an interpersonal thing. When I talk about racism, I'm talking about the structures in our country, the system. So here's the example. My father was in World War II, along with a number of my uncles, and they came back, and they used the GI Bill to get a free education. My father went to law school on the GI Bill, and they also used the GI Bill to get very, very low financing, and either no money down or hardly any money down to buy their first house. And my parents talked openly and often about how great the GI Bill was and you know how great America was for having a GI Bill and welcoming these soldiers back, and wasn't this wonderful? Well, it turns out that the GI Bill was not available to the 1 million black GIs who came back. And the number of black families who have a World War II veteran in their family who talk about how devastating it was to go over and fight for racial justice in the European arena and come back to America and not be treated equally. Just how devastating that was. And it was morally devastating, it was financially devastating. And here's how it worked. Nowhere in the GI Bill did it say blacks need not apply. Yet, on the housing front, the way the federal housing, the FHA was set up, and the lending regulations, they used a mapping system where they would take a city or neighborhoods and they would grade them based on the level of risk of the investment. So where I grew up in Winchester was considered a very safe. Suburban areas were generally green. And on the other end of these four categories was red. Red was considered a hazardous investment, so you would not put your money there. Guess what made a high or low risk neighborhood? Skin color. So when the FHA, the guidelines about evaluating property, the skin color of residents was equally as important to the condition of a building. So a black GI would come back, would want to get the GI Bill to go get a house, but the GI Bill wouldn't loan in the neighborhood where the black person would live. So that cut them out. There are a few exceptions. A friend of mine who is black grew up on a college campus, and her black GI father was able to access it because the college basically backed him. On that education front, well, what went on there was at that time there was a quota system in universities and colleges. So those spots filled up like that. The other thing that happened on the education front was a lot of these black GIs came home and they had to go to work for their families because, unlike my family, where on both sides of my family, my grandparents had Social Security. Social Security is another racialized program. Social Security in this country was designed for white-collar workers. It excluded agricultural and domestic workers, which were disproportionately black and brown. So my father didn't have to worry about supporting his parents, but many of the black GIs did. And so whether the spots were open or not, they had to go to work to support their parents. And this is, when I talk about compounding, this in this country at this point, 2014, we're living in a state of such compounded advantage and disadvantage, and most of us don't know it. And so we look at a black and brown, we, white people, and also you don't have to be white to not understand this, and this is what I think is so terrible. If you make an observation and you misinterpret it as that person must be inferior because they can't figure out how to live like this person who's making that observation, this is white, this is black, and there's all kinds of in-betweens, I internalized all this superiority. I completely believed that my people had superior genes and had worked harder and had, you know, somehow just figured out life a little bit better. And I will tell you that one of the saddest things in the world I have witnessed and I continue to witness is a black or brown child believing that the reason they don't live like their friends is because there's something wrong with them. And that's what gets me out of bed every morning because, you know, you're here from the public schools. Think about your own child. If you're, you know, a white person, you know how much we love our children and we want to protect them and we want them to feel great about themselves. Imagine that everything you do, every time they walk outside your door, they're being told that they are not trusted, they're not as smart. I mean, just, boy, that is really devastating to me. And what will those children grow up? So we're repeating this. This gets reproduced every day. And so the importance of understanding our history is so important. And so when I learned this, I was a wreck. I had to get sleeping pills, which I'm still addicted to. I can't get off of them. Because I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is, and the other thing is, you don't have to go to like some archive in the back of your government city hall to find this stuff. This history, you go home and Google GI Bill, redlining, GI Bill, racism, housing, you know, Google anything and put the word racism after it, food, racism. You'll find out how racial disparities show up in food, transportation, racism. You'll find out, you know, thousands of articles how it shows up. Health, racism. You'll find thousands of articles. You know, education, police, legal system, all of it. Racism shows up in all of our institutions every day. So when I realized the magnitude of the problem, I thought, well, I know so many good white people like me who aren't doing something because we didn't understand. Like, those are the people I'm trying to reach. I really don't care about the hardcore racists. I don't think that's America's problem. I think America's biggest problem in working towards racial justice is the white people in power who are well-intentioned and maybe doing what I did, thinking that they have to be generous and they have to be, you know, do something that's very patronizing. So my book is an attempt to get the history out there, and I thought about, I've got to make it juicy. I've got to make it like such a, I had just read Eat, Pray, Love, and Shay jokes with me. She said, this is like, you know, it's like Eat, Pray, Love. You really talk in that tone. And I did, you know, it was very intentional because I was like, what would have gotten to me? When I was 25 and starting to ask these questions and make these observations, what would have gotten to me? So this is the book that would have worked for me. Another interesting thing about the book is, I think it's interesting, this is version 10. Versions 1 through 9 were all manuscripts that, you know, the first one was maybe 40 pages, the next one was 100 pages, and each manuscript I had read by focus groups. I would have people who self-identified as white, confused and upset about race and want to learn more, and the other group would be people who identified as racial justice professionals. And every time I got so many comments, I got the questions. I have questions at the end of each chapter because at one point, you know, it was a black reader said, you know, it's not enough for me to people have a really interesting voyeuristic read, Debbie. I want them to do their own work. Please find a way to make white people look inside themselves, look into their own family history. So that's why there are questions at the end of each chapter. And I guess, you know, in general, I don't do reading because when I go hear an author, I want to hear the story behind the book. But I'm going to do a short, I am going to do a short reading. And then I'm going to stop and we're going to have questions. Okay, well, I'm going to read this because I want you to get a flavor of the tone I strike. Because what I know would have not worked for me was to make me feel guilty or make me feel ashamed. I didn't invent racism. No one in this room did, but we did all inherit it. And my parents passed on racism to me, and I've passed it on to my children. And understanding that is key, and understanding that from a place of love. And you know, this is a tragedy that we are all in the middle of. And if we start blaming each other, we're going to get nowhere. We need to just sit with ourselves and our own grief first before we can engage responsibly and, as you said, unapologetically. So the first chapter is called What Wasn't Said, and I usually have my book all marked up with me, and I didn't bring that one, so let's see. So, okay, so this is the first chapter, What Wasn't Said. I was obsessed with Indians, is what I called them as a kid, and it all started because at the Winchester Public Library, this was their huge, beautiful mural of horses and this lakeside and trees and this lush lawn, and there were these colonial types there, and they were having some kind of meeting with these Indians. And they were, you know, long hair and unbelievable feather fringe costumes, as I would call them back then. And I just wanted to be an Indian. I wanted to be an Indian so bad I couldn't stand it. And my mother, of course, the Winchester Hobby Shop sold little Indian collections. So I had an Indian collection and lots of little model horses. And I made like a little pond out of tin foil. And I lived with my Indian world. My mother even made me an Indian costume for Halloween that I wore several years in a row till it was like I was busting out of it. And so it's a Friday morning, and we have gone to the Winchester. We went every Friday morning, my mom and me, to the library. We're on our way home from the library. We're in the car, and I asked my mother whatever happened to all the Indians, and she said that they had drank themselves to death. Maybe she even used the word extinction, I'm not sure. But that was my take was, oh, my God. These people drank themselves to death? And I talk a little bit more about what my thinking was in there, but this is the part I'm going to read. I never question this narrative's truth or fullness, despite its dissonance with the peaceful images in my books. My mother, full of kindness and empathy, told it to me. I don't question that she believed it. She told me a version of a story as she had heard it from someone else who also likely believed it. I had no other more complete historical context in which to place this story about a nearly extinguished culture, now neatly tucked away on isolated reservations I didn't know existed. I had minimal knowledge of how Native peoples had long flourished in their own cultures before white Europeans decimated them with theirs. It makes me wonder how many lies and half-truths I've swallowed and in turn inadvertently passed along in my lifetime. Stereotypes, I've learned, are not so much incorrect as incomplete. It's true that alcohol was a factor in the waning of indigenous people. But there's infinitely more to the story. What my mother did not tell me was that the white colonists had purposely introduced alcohol to Native Americans, using it to weaken, subdue, and coerce them into signing over land and rights. She didn't explain how disease brought by our ancestors had infected and killed Indian men, women, and children, in some cases killing 90% of a Native nation's population. Nor did she tell me that those who survived disease found themselves in dehumanizing federal programs designed by white men to civilize Indians, separating them from one another and stripping them of the languages, customs, beliefs, and human bonds that had held them together for centuries. She didn't help me understand what it might have felt like for people as attached to their families and homes as I was to mine, to be torn from theirs. She didn't turn and gently ask me to imagine what it might be like to lose 9 out of 10 of my closest friends and family. She didn't tell me that today indigenous people use words like invaders and terrorists and genocide to describe the pilgrims and their actions. She didn't explain that the English coming to America was part of a larger historical pattern of white Europeans invading countries, exploiting resources, and civilizing people they considered to be savages, all in an entangled quest to dominate through Christianity and capitalism. She couldn't tell me any of these things because she herself had never learned them. The question I asked that Friday morning was typical of a young child trying to make meaning of the world around her. Unfortunately, my mother's own upbringing had left her lacking the necessary knowledge and life skills to connect me to my world through historical truths and critical analysis. Instead, I got hand-me-down snippets that never added up and left me feeling confused and upset. Neither my mother nor I understood that moment was one of many in which she was racializing me. Without ever once mentioning the words race or skin color, my mother passed along to me the belief that the two were connected to inherent human difference. Without meaning to, on that day or any other, my mother gravely misled me. She didn't do it because she was evil or stupid or had upholding racism on her mind. My mother was warm, compassionate, and bright. She told me the version of events as she knew them, errors and omissions included. Just as she had once done, I used my scant information to construct a story about humanity. Over the course of my childhood, the media confirmed my idea of Indians as savage and dangerous. I came to see them as drunks who grunted, whooped, yelled, and painted their faces to scare and scalp white people. What a tragedy that over time my natural curiosity, open mind, and loving heart dulled, keeping me from confronting wrongs I never knew existed. So that's the way I've written embedded history into my waking up experience. And I think at the end of that chapter, the question, and what was the first time you ever understood race or came into contact with a person? Racial difference. So with that, open up to questions. Okay, so he's asked the question that I'm going to talk about for 20 minutes. I'll try to keep it short. So I'm going to actually start with the, is this a unique American problem? Yes, the word white, all countries are susceptible to systems of oppression. Systems of oppression take many shapes and forms in many in countries. In America, the system of oppression is a white supremacist system of oppression. I'll do the cliff note. Should I spend time on this? I'm not going to spend time on that right now. Whiteness is unique to America. This is where the word white began, founding an entire country, beginning institutions with the idea of race as something that's real, and constructing all of your institutions in order to hoard resources for the people who you've called white. That's uniquely American. Colorism is a term. For instance, you may hear that, like in India, women are spending a lot of time bleaching their skin. So that's, colorism is the term. Classism is a form of, as a system of oppression in many countries. But racism, there's a unique flavor to American racism. Have I gotten, so the response to the book has been overwhelmingly positive. It's hard to describe. I mean, every day I get, at this point, so it came out January 20th, and so what are we like, 7 or 8 months out, and at this point I get 5 to 10 emails a day in my inbox from somebody who's read the book. This morning I woke up, Ferguson, Missouri. The city manager of Ferguson, Missouri has reached out to me, is reading my book. Phillips Andover Academy has hired me to be their Martin Luther King. This was this morning, the Martin Luther King speaker. And I had a long talk with a woman who is a black woman at Phillips Andover, Linda Griffiths, if anyone knows her. She's been there 25 years. And she said a lot of the language I most hear about this book is that the book is a game changer. Because by revealing my story, I'm freeing up white people to just be with me and my story and not feel attacked by the word white privilege and not get a lot of academic jargon, and that it's a way, it's a tool. I designed the book to be a tool. So it's a tool and people are using it. And that's really exciting. Some of the negative responses I've gotten, a friend of mine who's Asian feels like it's just so, and I'm sure I don't have many friends who, I have one friend who's a Latino friend. So in my I haven't gotten feedback, but I'm guessing that that my book is a little, because this is a 101. For me, when I was writing it, I'm getting more nuanced, but I was thinking very much in black race, white race, and I think that comes across in the book. So I can imagine people who feel underrepresented in the book, that's a hard thing. I'm imagining that's a criticism that I haven't heard enough of, and I'm going to hear more of. Then the other, I was on the anniversary of the Civil Rights, not that there's an anniversary, but there was one day that was designated as the 50th anniversary this year, and I was on MSNBC, the TV show The Cycle, that day. And it was my, I'm sitting here on a stage. This is new to me. I've never been on national television. And so I go on, and I'm on, and I think it goes pretty well. And by the time I get out of the building, I just want to, you know, text my husband and say, I don't know if you watched it. It was live, which added to the panic. I said, I don't know if you watched it. So I was just going to text him, and my phone was lit up. And it was the organized right, the conservative, Ku Klux Klan, I had 3 days of death threats. A 5 days later, someone had taken the time to piece together this whole poster of Debbie Irving must be killed. Cutting out separate letters and like gluing them together. It was so misogynistic. It was so awful. Facebook, Twitter, I got emails, I got phone calls. I was so shaken. But, you know, now that, I say I don't worry about those people. I think they're a fringe. And yet, they're the ones who are organized. Which is why the well-meaning white people, I just feel so strongly that there needs to be a critical mass of white people who understand how important it is to embrace our history and be real about it. I mean, truth and reconciliation, you know, South Africa's done it. America should be doing truth and reconciliation. And how did I get off on all of that? Was there negative? Yeah, there's been some negative feedback. But the people I want to reach, the well-intentioned, that critical mass of white people, what I didn't expect, to have such an outpouring of really like gratitude from people of color saying, thank you, because what you're saying, I could say till I'm blue in the face, and no one would ever listen to me. So thanks for saying it. I'm sorry, that's the way it is in this country, that sometimes it takes a white person to get through to another white person. Any system of oppression creates, sociologists call it a double bind. Most of us probably just think of it more as damned if you do, damned if you don't. And that is that, so as a female, in America's system of oppression, it overvalues white, men, Christian, straight, able-bodied, the whole host of what was the mindset that came over here. That was the group that founded this country, and that continues to this day to get normalized. And if you're not any of those, you're somehow, you know, you're one down. You're marginalized. You're not quite as valued as. And so as a female, for instance, if I want to speak up and say, you know, the way you just spoke to me was so patronizing. The double bind is that if I don't say that, I continue to feel like I'm weak because I couldn't say that. And it hurts. I'm stuffing this pain inside. And if I do say it, I'm going to get labeled that angry white, not angry white, I'm getting race confused, that angry woman, you know? And so that's the double bind. And then another important piece of this is that what I had no idea how much racism exhausts people of color. Psychically, physically, just exhausts. And so for white people to ask people of color to educate them about how racism works is exhausting. And so there, I've gotten many times the message of, you know, it is go educate your white friends, Debbie, so I don't have to do it. You know, white spaces, we're so polite with each other.
Oh my God. As you get older, it gets a little easier.
Yeah, right. There's less to lose. But, as you know, and one of the things that occurred to me is that if you're raised in an environment where you just avoid conflict, you don't develop skills to navigate it. And so once you develop skills to navigate conflict, it's much easier. I don't avoid it as much. I still sometimes avoid conflict. That always, you know, when it comes up, it's just like I get that whole feeling. But this is why developing conversational skills is so important. When people, a lot of times, a white person in the audience will say, oh my God, I get what you're saying, what do I do? And I always say, you know, educate, engage, and donate. So educating ourselves, white people, is hugely important. And engaging is so important. Engaging in spaces, and now I'm still talking about talking. So, you know, it's like, well, what are we going to do, talk about it for the rest of our lives? But the difference is that once the education. And the reason I say donate is because there is an infrastructure of racial justice organizations. We just heard of some of them in this, in your own city. They need money. So if you can't do anything else, write a big fat check and support these organizations. So because they're the ones who can facilitate the education and the engaging. So now, you know, once white people get more comfortable having this conversation, next time they have a pool of applicants or the next time they have a job opening, they may start to think differently. As a white teacher, I would approach teaching completely differently if I were back in the classroom. I would hope that, I mean, I think every police force, someone brought this up last night, shouldn't every police department in this country have an education on this? So what would the end result be there? You know, less profiling, more respect, you know, triple respect maybe even, overcompensating on the respect end for all the disrespect done over the years. So I just, you know, you can't, I feel like it's a step that can't be skipped. Like, you can't go to action with a bunch of ignorant white people. Or they will overtake the space. They won't. I hear you talking with the Truth and Reconciliation about, you know, this is a big thing, is that, okay, now here, look at how, here we are talking about racism, and as a white person talking about it, like, it's actually, there's a lot more information to become. I'm so sad Shay's not here. But white people don't need to take over the racial justice movement. White people need to create receptivity amongst other white people for the racial justice movement to embrace the voices of people of color who have all the answers and have for years. They're the ones living the experience. So I think that's creating white receptivity, if I had to boil it down. So what she's talking about is what's considered normal in white spaces is to say, "It's nice to meet you. Where are you from? Where do you work?" "Well, yeah, where'd you go to college?" "We're just summer." That's a class thing. Those are so offensive to people who feel like, you know, oh, wait, you have to figure out who I am before you can relate to me. Just relate to me as a person. So that was a shocker. See, there were many aha moments. There wasn't one. "Hey, how are you?" is always a good one. You know, where if you're at the Portland Public Library, I've never been in this space. This is beautiful. I mean, it's amazing once you start practicing. You don't have to commit to a big, long conversation. And this person might not even want to talk to you. That doesn't matter what color they are. You might be super friendly and chatty, and they might not. But, you know, you just put out one bit at a time and see where the conversation goes and just avoid the, "It's nice to meet you. Where are you from?" So, anyway, thanks for asking that, because that's a practical takeaway. Thank you all so much for coming. And
this podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.